Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host and Blade Runner, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage, and I am so exhilarated right now. This music just makes me want to get out there and...
Just makes you want to hop in a flying car and, yeah, no, take off in your flying car and hunt down replicants. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's going to be a good one. End Credits is your local movie show for local movie fans, and you can hear us here every Thursday at 10 a.m., at least for the foreseeable future, and who knows what'll happen next week. But it's been 3 weeks in a row, so we're doing something right. Anyway,
as long as you're just on once every week, on someday.
Exactly.
I think that's good.
Exactly. That is exactly right. So we talk about the latest in pop culture news and review the newest movies. This week, that will be, of course, Blade Runner 2049. But since this is like kind of an epic occasion, you know, for a sequel to really like a classic cult film in the form of Blade Runner, we thought we would dedicate the first half to actually looking back at the original Blade Runner. So before digging into the sequel, we're going to take a look back at that original. It's a cult classic. It's an inspiration. It's a masterpiece, some would say. Whatever you want to call it, it is the 1982 Blade Runner film by Ridley Scott. And why don't we kick it off with a clip?
She's a replicant, isn't she?
I'm impressed. How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
It took more than 100 for Rachel, didn't it?
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto. Rachel is an experiment, nothing more.
We began to recognize in them strange obsession. After all, they are emotionally inexperienced with only a few years in which to store up the experiences which you and I take for granted. If we gift them with the past, we create a cushion or pillow for their emotions, and consequently we can control them better.
Memories. You're talking about memories.
So that was Harrison Ford there, and I think, you know, it's interesting when you're sort of coming up and you're developing your movie sort of, I don't know, dialogue and you know, looking at different things. And you encounter Harrison Ford, and you usually first encounter him in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And then you will move on to Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. And then if you're like, I like this guy. I like you know, how he is and the way he acts and how, like, heroic he is. And then maybe you come to Blade Runner. I think maybe this is where, I can't say for certain where it went wrong in 82, because you have these big Blade Runner posters of Harrison Ford, you know, shooting guns and in flying cars, and people were like, oh, it's like Star Wars but different. And then I think a lot of people went and saw it, and I think it was like what happened with Mother a couple of weeks ago, where yeah, everyone went in thinking that this is going to be some scary movie and not mm-hmm. some meditation on like the Book of Genesis and Darren Aronofsky's own conflicted feelings about his relationship. So mm-hmm. people, I think at the time, maybe sort of dismiss it out of hand, but you know, it's so hard not to look at this movie and not see like 30 years of pop culture coming out of it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I can imagine that at the time people were just a little like, what? But now, of course, and not now, but even for the last like 20 years or so, looking back on it, it's just so dramatic, the influence that it was going to have. Mm-hmm. You know, it... Yeah, I can imagine it was a marketing nightmare trying to figure out how to market this film.
Yeah.
Even now, I don't really know how you would market it.
Right. Now it's marketed just on being Blade Runner.
Yeah. I mean, sort of skipping ahead a little bit to the second half, the whole new movie is also marketed as, it's Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
So.
You're right.
I think this is just a not to knock the films whatsoever, but it mm-hmm. is a really challenging thing to market these stories.
And, you know, watching it again, there's something so familiar to it if you're familiar with the language of cinema. And it's glad, speaking of jumping ahead, it's something I'm glad that Denis Villeneuve picked up on when he made the sequel, which is that it's film noir. Mm-hmm. You know, it just so happens to be about flying cars and about replicants and DNA sequencing and, you know, sort of people who create fishes on every corner and holograms and things. But it's so steeped in the language of film noir.
Yeah, it is. It's very pulp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like pulp film noir. It's, you know, and I would agree that I think that was probably part of what made it really challenging, because that was a style of filmmaking that was almost 30 years old by the time, you know, Blade Runner came out.
Yeah.
Now I think it's a little bit easier, because I think there are a lot of people, both in the film industry and outside the film industry, who sort of are going back and reviewing this film noir genre. So it's a little easier now to market a film that way.
And it's on TV too.
What, film noir?
Well,
or
yeah.
TV noir.
TV noir, but like, yeah, the influences of film noir, you know,
yes,
something like Breaking Bad.
Veronica Mars.
Or Veronica Mars, or yeah, True Detective is steeped in that tradition as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think the other thing that makes it challenging is because of that film noir aspect. You know, it's so cold. It's so distant. It's so tricky because... Also, the language of it, too, when, you know, right from the scroll at the beginning where it's talking about, oh, you know, like, we created replicants to work off world. They're a slave labor force. And when they get out of hand, we don't kill them. We, wink, wink, retire them. And so the whole language of it is, you're not really killing these, you know, they're just things. And you heard in the clip there, Harrison Ford called, he meets this replicant, Rachel, who doesn't know she's a replicant, mm-hmm, because as the guy who created them in that clip, Tyrell, is explaining she was experiment. Like, can we make a replicant who doesn't think they're a replicant?
More human than human.
More human than human.
Drop
is our
in some white zombie right now.
More human than human is our motto. And he says, and that's, you know, I wonder if that's almost the message of the film it ended up being as well, that, you know, you recreate these things with the goal of making them human-like. We don't treat them like human, mm-hmm, but it's sort of up to them to make a stand for their own human rights that they're not willing to grant it, which is kind of the whole point of Roy Batty, who's the quote-unquote, mm-hmm, villain, and all,
yeah,
the other replicants in that Deckard, the Harrison Ford character, is chasing down.
Well, and I think actually that particular clip from Tyrell actually really points out two themes of, mm-hmm, the story and the world, mm-hmm, you know, the sort of world building. One is that it's about commerce.
Yeah.
Right. He says it. It's about commerce. We are trying to make money, and
which
we're
is very
doing
80s
it.
Theme. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's very now themed.
It's very
too,
now theme
really,
too.
Right? It's almost, the 80s were very much about commerce. He didn't come off like a bad guy per se in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
He did sort of come off, you know, in a very 80s fashion. It's like, oh, it's the Wall Street guy, right? It's
yeah,
about like making a lot of money. But then all of the rest of the film deals with that. What is life?
Right.
Right. They say it's about commerce and it's about creating something that's more human than human. Well, are humans just naturally given life?
Right.
If this is more human than human, does it have more life, less life? What's the...
And one thing I'll note about Tyrell is that there's the way the actor delivers that line, it's almost like he's like reading it off a script, which, mm-hmm, I mean... That,
his
like,
marketing materials.
Yeah, his marketing materials. Because he when he encounters Roy later, and he's like, well, you've done... And Roy tells him, well, I've done, like, these terrible things. But he's like, but you've also done extraordinary things. And, you know, how the light that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And so there's an element of pride in this now, which is he's created these things. And, yeah, it may have been for base, crass, commercial reasons that they need people, to, you know, human labor off-world, which is another...
And human recreation. Let's
and
not
human
forget
recreation,
the...
right. But they basically need people to do things people don't want to do, which is, of course,
yeah,
a very heavy historical theme, because that has been sort of the root of a lot of slavery and even modern human trafficking. So even he's getting, I think, key in that line reading, he's getting fed up with his BS too, which is why he would make something like, mm-hmm, Rachel, who didn't know or designed to not know her, the nature of her existence.
Yeah, almost as though he was trying to give her a real chance at life.
Yeah.
Whereas the other ones, that is actually what the other four, I think there's actually five of them who arrived,
yeah,
but there's only four primarily in the film.
Yeah, two of them, it's mentioned in the film, two of them are killed in the process of, mm-hmm, their trying to escape.
So. Yeah. So that's ultimately what they're asking for, mm-hmm. is an actual chance to live.
Yeah.
They understand that they're replicants. They also understand that they have a termination date.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand why, sure, maybe my useful life is done at this point. So I'm done serving you. Now don't I get to have my own life? And so now Terrell has created this other replicant. I don't know if we want to call her Nexus 7. I don't know.
It's a good question. It's, but yeah. Was she a one-off or was she like a prototype? Or
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we may know if I actually go back and read some of those other, because there are actually 3 short films that have been released this year to bridge the gap between Blade Runner and 2049.
Yeah.
And one of them is about the Nexus models. So maybe
I hate when movies give you homework, but okay.
I know, right? but yeah, that's the whole thing. Like the earlier ones, they said, okay, great. Now, like, we've served you.
Mm.
Now let's have our own life. And now we have Rachel, whose whole reason for being is just for her to have life.
Right. It's a weird kind of juxtaposition. And on top of all the life stuff too, there's an element of termination, the idea of termination in the human figures we meet too, because I'm thinking of particular the J.F. Sebastian character, mm-hmm. who works for Tyrell and it's never explained precisely what people do.
Yeah.
You don't want to get bogged down in the techno babble.
A lot of things are not explained precisely in this movie. Let's just
I want to get to that in a bit, but I want to make this point about the Sebastian character is played by William Sanderson, who is 25, and I don't think William Sanderson was 25 when this was made.
No, but he definitely did not seem 25.
But also, it's because he has this genetic disorder that prevents him from going off world.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have all these human characters. They're being sold up above by these like zeppelins with the billboards on, like, get to the off-world colonies where everything is awesome, it's nirvana, and you'll have wide open spaces and a great life. And it's like, well, the fact of the matter is there are a lot of people on Earth who aren't going to get there for various biological and genetic reasons that, mm-hmm. you know, they're stuck on Earth. And so it's kind of, you know, being in so much as having a self-determination is sort of rubbed in the faces of the replicants, being able to get off Earth and go somewhere better, that mm-hmm. idea is rubbed in the face of people like the Sebastian character.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hadn't really thought of that because I was just more with the Sebastian character. I was just sort of more concerned with the, because he tinkers and makes things, and he sort of reminded me of, and he didn't really have a lot to do in this film. A lot of people didn't have a lot to do in this film, but he didn't really have a lot to do in this film. But it would be interesting to learn more about who he is and what he does, because it feels like the kind of person, unlike Terrell, who I think was pretty clear about what his motivations are.
Mm-hmm.
Both, you know, it's about commerce and more human than human. Like, he's, you know, there's sort of two. This was my motivation before, and now I've reached a point, and now this is my motivation going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Sebastian is sort of I just am good at this and know how to do it, so I will. And I haven't actually stopped to think about what it is I do or why. So it's almost like the scientist who just does things because we can.
And there's also an element of loneliness there too, because he lives mm-hmm. in this big empty building. And so these tinker toys of, or I guess they're early replicants or maybe defective replicants that he takes, and he sort of makes his comrades, and he kind of surrounds himself with them. So it's a, you know, his is a very sad story that we don't mm-hmm. learn a lot about, but it just the way he lives and how he lives paints a very sad picture in just sort of a few scenes, mm-hmm. which is, I think, is also maybe emblematic of this entire world where you're sort of marching hither and yon under rain-soaked skies and grimy.
Yeah, nothing looks particularly hopeful.
No.
In this world.
Right. You don't want to live there, because that's the thing. It opens up with the skyline of Los Angeles, and there's no smokestacks. There's fire stacks. You see, like, fire bursts coming out of these smokestacks. Then you see a flying car overhead, and of course, you meet that's cool, a flying car. But the flying car is the only thing that are sort of even remotely appealing about living in this place. So it's just kind of depressing from the start. It's, you know, it makes you wonder, how did they get here, and how did, like, basically, you know, no one care about turning everything into a dark, bleak hellscape that from which there's no escape. There's literally no escape unless you pass a physical to get on a shuttle off world. So
I believe it's commerce.
It is commerce. It is commerce. You mentioned the world building, and I want to tip my hat to that, because you're right. So much of what this is unexplained, and it extends to the sequel too. They don't take the time to explain anything. And there's this character Gaff, who's played by Edward James Olmos.
Yeah, what's up with Gaff?
Yeah, he just walks up to Deckard and he starts talking this bizarre language and is not subtitled.
No.
It doesn't sound like anything, though I read on a website somewhere, it's like a mix of Hungarian and Chinese and a bunch of languages that probably don't really fit together.
Yeah, and I suspect the idea is that there are so many cultures living together that it's become like a patois of a variety of languages. So,
but yeah, they don't, you know... They don't have subtitles. It's not, you know, he has the guy at he's at a food counter, you know, eating lunch or something, and he has the guy explaining, he's Captain Bryant sent him, and it's interesting to go through this entire movie and it's not to not have anything explained, because I think this is the mistake that a lot of films that do world building is that what people living in a world don't need stuff explained to them.
No, they sure don't.
Which is why, you know, Harry Potter kind of works, because Harry is new to the wizarding world and he does need things explained.
Harry
to
and
him.
Hermione are both new to the wizarding world. So
very true, but Hermione...
she reads her own information.
She's very self-actualized. But you know, when you're watching something like the Resident Evil movies, let's say, and they're always like explaining, like, well, this is what this is, this is what this is. It's like, well, shouldn't you know that automatically? Living in this world, it's like... you know, us going outside and me saying, Candace, what is that thing rolling along that hard surface there? You know, I don't understand this.
That would be a bus.
Yeah.
It transports people from one place to another.
Right. So, I love how that's never, you know, things are never explained, and, it just forces you to sort of be nimble and to keep up, and, you know, given the movie audience, again, that might be another turnoff. So, I mean, this movie, I think, does almost everything, despite it being dressed up in blockbuster clothes, it does almost everything to not invite people who just, you know, who just want to sit back and enjoy something. It's something that you have to get in and you have to pay attention to, and you have to follow the lines and the bouncing ball, and it involves a lot of characters who you barely meet.
Yeah.
And if you do, like, sort of meet them, you know, they're in this grimy world where they're, you know, drinking or eating or, you know, going to these...
putting really dark eye makeup on.
Dark.
And veils. You know, very typical things that would happen in 2020. I look forward to...
I look forward to our grimy universe.
Yeah, my very, very white... face makeup with very dark eye makeup. I look forward to it.
It's good. That was a good look for Daryl Hannah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When did you first see this, may I ask?
So that's an interesting question.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So I rewatched this film this week, and so I think it's fair for us to actually say which version, because you talked about it. We watched the 8th version of this film called The Final Cut, which may or may not be the final version. Who knows?
Well, that's true.
But we did watch the one that was released about 10 years ago, titled The Final Cut.
Yeah, the 25th anniversary
edition. And technically, it's... actually a director-approved cut, as opposed to the director's cut, which was not approved by release. Whatever. I don't know. So after I watched it, I sort of thought to myself, okay, what version was I watching when I was younger? Because I honestly do not remember. We owned a copy, a VHS copy. My family were very into science fiction films and just very into films in general. And so basically from the time we woke up on Saturday mornings until the time we put whatever new rented movie we were watching on at around 7 p.m. at night, and all day Sunday, we just had movies on. We would just throw movies in while we were going about our, you know, doing homework, chores, cooking, painting, whatever we were doing. So this, like Blade Runner, was one that was really often on in the background. And I know that my mom really liked it because my mom really likes Harrison Ford, because all moms really like Harrison Ford.
I mean,
many women my age really like Harrison Ford, or really liked Harrison Ford then.
Yeah.
He's a little grizzled now, and not in a good way like Sam Elliott. Sorry, that was a total sidetrack. I'm just here to objectify men. That's why I'm invited to the show, right?
Fair enough. Okay. Yeah. No. You are fulfilling your mandate.
Blade Runner was on a lot, and I feel like I remember the film with the narration and to be more noir-based, and I think... So the director's cut is the one with the narration and the extra bit at the end where we actually see beyond the elevator doors closing. I'm pretty sure that's the version that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always really liked film noir, and I really identified that as film noir. And I also feel like while there were problems with that, and some people really hate the narration, including Ridley Scott and Harrison Ford, I feel like for me, that's the version that actually meets the genre more and makes it a little less hard to sort of go, what am I watching? And
right.
Not that I think you need the narration to understand, but the narration is there to actually make Deckard a real character who takes actions.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't, really.
Yeah.
He is a character with things that happen to him.
Right.
I mean, the whole film, like, he really does not do anything. He you know, happens to be in the right place at the right time, or people come to him, which is fine in a film noir where the narrator is talking about, well, this is the story of what happened.
Right.
And often that narrator isn't actually the central actor in the film. They're the person who's there that all the film works around them. And that's very much what Deckard is. So to me, I feel like that the narration version makes it more noir, and I'm fairly certain that's the version that I was watching when I was younger.
Yeah, that does sound like the theatrical cut, and I don't think I've ever seen the theatrical cut. I've seen the quote-unquote director's cut, which does end when the elevator closes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that says something very much about the vision that Ridley Scott had, which noir does tend to end on an ambiguous note.
Yeah, and I'm fine. Like, the elevator doors closing is a much better ending than the one that was tacked on.
Right.
At the end. But I liked that. I think the narration.
Yeah, because most hard-boiled detective stuff is like, I was waiting for her in my office for this call to come in, and she walked in. And I get that. But hearing you talk about that and hearing you talk about that feeling, which is probably why those changes were made, because those were, again, studio-mandated changes, mm-hmm. I have a feeling Ridley Scott wanted to go more in the direction of how this is now with the final cut. And I did rewatch the final cut, and I also have the director's cut on DVD at home. You'd probably have to work pretty hard to find a theatrical cut somewhere.
Yeah.
Although, I being a film preservation nut, I think it would be interesting if that were available somehow. But I understand why it isn't. And it's interesting to hear you talk about making, you know, stuff more clear and making Deckard more reactive, because that is the thing, is that he is the bouncing ball going from one place to the next, and he isn't really detecting anything.
No, he really is.
He's
not.
Like, somebody tells him where to go and he goes there, and then
then someone is there and starts shooting at him, so
and
he
then
shoots back.
He gets into a fight or somebody finds him, and so he is not a very proactive character, which maybe something that Denis Villeneuve in the screenwriters of 2049 mm-hmm. hit upon and then we're going to get into that shortly. But the ending is interesting, because maybe this is where we can launch from in getting ready to talk about 2049, because there is that lingering mystery, and has been for years,
that
is Deckard a replicant? And having watched this several times when I rewatched it this week, I didn't mm-hmm. keep that in mind. But there have been other times I've watched it trying to look for clues, like, is he a replicant?
Yeah.
And I've honestly never seen it.
Yeah, see, and so just watching the film as it is, I agree, I don't see it. But having watched 2049,
mm-hmm.
I look back and I can go, huh, maybe here is a clue, and maybe there is a clue. And that's not to say that the question is actually even answered.
Right.
Particularly in the new one. But I think now, thinking back, I can look at it and think a little bit more that I believe that, yes, he is a replicant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I believed that at the time as well. But just because things were a little weird. I think the main, you know, the other problem I had rewatching it this week was just like, what did I like about this film when I was younger that it was on all the time? And that's not to say that it's not a good film, again, but I just can't look at it and think about me as like 10 or 11, 12 years old, really into science fiction and you know, not interested in slow moving films or things like that. But I just sort of watch it and I think, I don't know that I ever really understood it or particularly, right. I feel like I watched it very much just as from the world building. Like,
yeah.
And I think a lot of people just, they don't really know what the movie is about, but they just remember very amazing, intense visuals from it. Because as I'm watching it, I'm going, I don't think I could have told you what the film was about, even though it was on like a lot growing up.
This isn't a film so much that you watch so much as a film you talk about, I think. And that goes, you know, right up until almost the very end and, you know, before the last scene in the final fight with Roy Batty, because watching that fight, it's not like a fight. It's not like two people trying to, you know, undo the other one and knock out the other one. Deckard's kind of like running for his life and fighting for his life. But Roy isn't fighting for his life.
No, because at that point he's already accepted his fate.
Yeah.
And so he's just, I think, fighting for...
Because there's actually very little fight. There's
justice? I don't know.
I'm not even sure he's fighting for anything. I think it was him like wanting a good death, which is kind of plays into that... It plays into what is life, but it also plays into his little monologue at the end about how, you know, all these memories he had are like lost in the rain. And there's something sort of very fatalistic about it. But yeah, the whole fight is there isn't a fight. Like there's some gunfire. He breaks Deckard's fingers, shoves him through a wall. But then the rest of it is Deckard running away and then Roy running through the building, taunting him and howling at him. And it's almost pointless in a way, but I mean, but I think from Roy's perspective, it's very much like the acceptance of his death, and then looking for sort of like one last, you know, I don't know, kick at the can, like maybe he's trying to dare Deckard to finish him off and go out in a blaze of glory. But there's something very fatalistic about it, and of course that leads also into Gaff's line in English. Which, you know, he says to Deckard, it's too bad she won't live, but then again, who does? Which is quite true, but also, you know, kind of fatalistic, too. And then, of course, in that hallway scene at the end, we see the origami unicorn that said that Gaff was there. But...
Yeah. Well, and so this is the thing. I think Gaff is the only clue for me prior to watching 2049. The only clue for me was Gaff and not his origami because I really didn't understand any of that or how it related to anything.
Yeah.
But the fact that he always knew where to find Deckard.
Yeah.
And he just showed up, right? Deckard is the Blade Runner. So he's the one who's tasked to go retire all of these. And clearly everybody else knows where they are because, like, they're in this abandoned building and, like, who has any idea where Deckard is in this world, this you know, New York City, or is it Los Angeles?
It's Los Angeles.
It's Los Angeles of the future with billions of people, and it's dark and nothing is lit. And Roy Batty literally just says his last lines. And in the background, there's Gaff with the car saying, I guess you're done now.
Yeah.
I was like, so why couldn't you take care of this? Because clearly you know where everything is going on. So that, for me, was always the one sort of clue that there's something a little funny here. Like, why did they send him on this when clearly they, like, who is Gaff and what is his purpose in this? If not to be the handler of this person that he's...
I suppose, but I think there's a feeling that maybe Gaff has, that the Deckard doesn't have an official police function, that maybe he's like kind of a black ops kind of cop that is taking care of this wet work, that maybe Gaff's sort of the official arm who's kind of like shadowing him. That is interesting, though, but unfortunately we'll have to reserve the who is Gaff discussion for another time. We're going to take a musical break, and apropos, I found this little ditty. It's from Partner, and they are on the CFRU charts right now, and they're actually playing Ebar as well on October 27th. But if there's anyone who knows that Deckard is human or a replicant, it's Partner with their song, Everybody. It's not even related, but the song called Everybody Knows. So when you hear the lyrics, you'll know, you'll realize it's not even about remotely about Blade Runner. But anyway,
you're listening. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. But I had a class, I knew I had to go to, so I dragged my ass and chose, because I knew she had to go too. And on the deck, while I waited for her to get dressed, sparked up another one, and I was such a mess that I confess that my professor wouldn't look me in the eye. Listen, everybody knows you're high.
Nickel is for the colonial ships, closest any of them or any of us is gonna get to that grand life off world. So come on now. What sort do you have in mind? Because I got all kinds. Oh, no, no.
I'm not buying.
No, no, no. This is just my game, and I play it fair. No, no, I mean, bigger than you. Bigger than you were trying to shut me down. Bigger than you, and they were men at that.
And that was Your Boyfriend and Mine, Ryan Gosling, in Blade Runner 2049. It's a new film from Denis Villeneuve, and it co-stars Harrison Ford, Robin Wright, Ana de Armas, and Jared Leto. And as we said at the top of the show, 35 years in the making.
Well, not like officially 35 years.
Not officially 35 years.
But probably
years,
at least 12.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when this was announced and Ridley Scott's like, we're doing another Blade Runner. I was like, please no.
And I'm pretty sure Harrison Ford said, please no also. You are? You don't want me for this, right?
Well, that was the thing, too. I think when they announced the sequel, they announced him. And my first thought was like, well, there goes the replicant theory. But
interesting. Because I thought, oh, I guess we have to finally agree that he is a replicant.
Yeah. Okay.
That's so interesting that we had such completely differing ideas about what does it mean that Harrison Ford is in it.
True. Although I figured that would be answered. It really doesn't end up being answered. Let's phrase this first of all by saying this is a difficult movie to discuss without spoilers. So there will be spoilers in the discussion. So there, turn your radio off or turn the podcast off. However you're listening to this, wait until you've seen the movie, if you're waiting to see the movie. I realize it's 10:30 in the day and turning the radio off may not be practical wherever you are. But stick your fingers in your ears and mom. This was easier when we were out Wednesday at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm pretty sure that you've already seen the film. Let's be realistic. Not you. I mean, you the listener.
You the audience, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it had some pretty good, there's a lot of people in the audience yesterday. I feel like there's a lot of hype around this movie. So if you care, you've probably seen it already.
That's a good point. So let's get into it. Speaking of the whole, is he or isn't he a replicant in a debate? What I liked is, like, right off the bat, it acknowledges Ryan Gosling's character, Kay, is a replicant.
Yep.
So that's almost
straight
seems like a direct response to that whole debate. And Denis Villeneuve's like, no, he's a replicant. Okay, now that that's out of the way, let's go to this other adventure. So, so it's, to go back to what I said in the first half was, it's very much of the mind that this was a noir universe, that it's a detective story, and it's, you know, very ground level like that. Nobody's trying to save the world, although there's a lot of talk about what certain implications mean. But it's never about that. And I think this is where a lot of these kind of legacy sequels go off the rails.
Is
they forget what the original was all about. And I come back to Terminator about this. The Terminator movies keep... The sequels, anyway, are constantly about more action, more focus on the war, more focus on time travel, and that's never what Terminator was about. It was a slasher movie, straight up killing machine, chasing a couple. That's it. And so at least in this, Denis Villeneuve, who famously said he took the job because he didn't want anyone else to F it up.
Yeah.
So at least Denis Villeneuve was true to his word on that. He knew what it took to not F it up, as it were.
Yeah, and it's true. Well, I do think the stakes are raised slightly in this, because it is quite a bit into the future, and they do they needed to explain a little bit more about the replicants in the world and mm-hmm. things like that. At the base of it, it's still just a mystery mm-hmm. story and or detective story, right? It's literally about, here's a mystery and people are trying to unravel it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this unraveling is a little more convoluted.
Yes.
It's a bigger story.
Yeah.
So it's a little more convoluted, but it's also more actively done by the main character. The main character actually asks questions.
He does detective
and
work.
And goes places and learns. He even like spends some time looking at the 2049 version of microfiche.
Yeah, that's right. There's DNA on microfiche in the middle part of the century, which is weird. But okay, I guess that is sort of explained by, again, it does this cool world building thing where they don't explain anything. And you find out there's this blackout at this global blackout at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really neat how they did that. He goes to the old Tyrell Corporation to find out, files. And the guy's like, hey, where were you during the global blackout? This happened to me and this happened to me. And then all the bank records were erased. And my dad was pretty glad about that.
Yeah, that worked out all right for me.
Yeah. So I do love those little details, because you don't need to tell me the story about, hey, do you remember back in 1986 when such and such and such and such happened? And mm-hmm. then this happened.
And that was almost 40 minutes into the movie, I think, before, we started talking about that. And it only just came up, like, in that one bit of sentence, and then two more times in the future it sort of came up when they were looking for more information, because the idea is that this the information they're looking for is from before the blackout, so a lot of the electronic data is wiped. So
It's an elegant way of making it harder, because otherwise you'd be like, why doesn't he just go to Google and look this stuff up? So that was pretty clever. And talking about how this was a world in the 82 movie you don't want to live in, mm-hmm. you really don't want to live in this one, because it's like ash is falling from the sky all the time, and there's mm-hmm. a seawall that, clearly an implication that global warming and has taken a toll, and that you have to have this huge seawall to keep out the ocean now.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's sort of one of those incredibly subtle things about the first film,
mm-hmm.
and one of those things that you do understand a lot if you do any research into the film, or if you've read Philip K. Dick's novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? I always get the electric. I'm like, where's the electric go in this title? Do electric androids dream? Well, whatever. So if you've read the novel, which I haven't read it, but, I've done a lot of research.
We're not readers here. We've established this on previous show. No one here is a reader.
But, what they didn't really explain very well in the first film, and they didn't really talk about so much in this film either, but you understand the implications of it if you do know this, is that basically there are no animals. Like, animals are kind of extinct.
Yeah.
And the animals that you see are all much like the replicants. They're created through cloning and things like that.
That's right.
So in this future, they do immediately start by talking about how people are eating in this incredibly overpopulated, obviously not growing planet that we have. Like, there's no sunshine. Well, when there is, it's just,
it's gray, it's blah. It's like the sky is milk. It's not blue or anything. That's the only way the sun is up, is it's not as dark.
It's just
which of course plays very well into Roger Deakins, who's the cinematographer, mm-hmm. plays into his proclivities. A lot of people probably most familiar with his work from Skyfall, which a lot of people remember from the scene in, I think it's Shanghai, where James Bond goes to assassinate the guy, but it's all done with the sort of the neon blues and purples mm-hmm. of the street signs, and then in the end where the house is on fire and that's the only light there is.
Yeah, and this is a very blue and orange, muted orange landscape.
Yeah, and even if you don't know the name Roger Deakins, you know the work, and this plays into that into his proclivities so well.
But you should know the name because he is favorite cinematographer.
He is very, very good, and he of course worked with Denis Villeneuve on Sicario, which was almost the antidote to this, because so much of what happened in Sicario was in the bright light of day, mm-hmm. the overwhelming sunlight of along the Mexico border. So it's, you know, apples and oranges almost, his work here. And the thing about the environment I find interesting, because there's even that line in the Void Comtesse in the first film about where he says, what if somebody gave you a calfskin wallet? And she's like, oh, I would report them to police, because why? It'd be probably illegal to have mm-hmm. animal skin. Yeah. So, yeah, there's just so many great details about this world and about, you know, just the unyielding hellscape it is. And mm-hmm. and everyone's okay with it. It's just the way it is.
That's the depressing part.
Which is the depressing part.
That's the really depressing part, that everybody's just okay with it, except for the kind of bad guys, or who we're supposed to, you know, believe right. are the bad guys, right? In the first film, Terrell isn't so much a bad guy, but,
yeah.
you know, clearly he's the one who's trying to create life, and he's sort of set up a little bit as a bad guy, and then all the other replicants are just trying to create themselves a life, but we're supposed to believe they're bad guys. And then right. in this new film... not only are we supposed to believe it, I think Jared Leto did a really good, awful job of being horrible. Like, I just... but...
Every decision he makes yeah. is so calculated.
Yeah.
And I'm not someone who thinks a lot about Jared Leto, mm-hmm. but just he... I think everyone else was so good at mm-hmm. just the way he was acting and the way how stilted he was and how precise every yeah. word he said was.
Yeah.
It's just he everything he did was just so calculated yeah. with this, and I found it quite... annoying.
I know. I can come back to his performance in a second, but the actual his character, right, while evil, just evil and,
yeah.
and gross and very overly egotistical
yeah.
and had a god complex,
yeah.
but he also realized that, you know, the cure for this horrible world that we live in is more replicants. So he is actually, like, he's one of the few people in this world who is actually trying to actively change the world.
Yeah.
But by doing horrible things. Well, what we're led to believe are horrible things. I do think yeah. they're horrible as well, but.
Right. Yeah. I guess that's part of the noir. There's really no heroes and no villains either. Mm-hmm. Is that, and although, yeah. Even considering Roy Batty and the other replicants in the first film, there is something rather clearly clinically evil about Jared Leto's character Wallace, mm-hmm. who was also, as you mentioned, the savior of the humans on Earth by inventing yeah. synthetic proteins that, you know, that since nothing can be grown, as we pointed yeah. out. I do want to give particular notice to the actress Sylvia Hooks, I think her name is, but she plays his enforcer.
She was probably my favorite thing about this film.
She was really, really good.
I really, really enjoyed her performance.
Because she's so reserved in those first scenes, and she seems like the proper assistant and very quiet and soft-spoken. And then later when she's like turning the city upside down trying to find Kay, which is Ryan Gosling's character, and find out what he knows, and she's just ruthless. She's just
yeah.
completely... methodical, and she's like a Terminator almost, oddly, if
yeah.
since we're comparing
Though,
sci-fi things.
I do feel at the same time that she really did actually show emotion.
Yeah.
She, you know, and I feel like while she was set on this task
mm-hmm.
To find, I don't know if we're just going to go ahead and spoil it, but to find the thing that she's trying to find. So she's set on this task by Wallace,
yeah.
and she's also made it clear that she is for Wallace. Like, that's her yeah. whole existence, is so that she can serve him. I really started to believe that for her, because she is a replicant,
mm-hmm.
what the thing they're trying to find has serious implications
mm-hmm.
around life and being a replicant and all those sorts of things. And I really started to feel that she was having like a burning need to find this as well.
Yeah.
And I suspect that when she did, she might have started to have some conflicts. But what do I do now? Like,
right.
you know, because now I'm looking at my own life, my own existence, my own soul, maybe.
Right.
And am I okay with this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is exactly what Kay said when he was given the task as well. The first thing he said was, I've never killed anything
with a soul before.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's. Let's just go ahead and spoil it. The mystery is that Kay is out, and basically they've created replicants to hunt other replicants, mm-hmm. to be basically replicant Blade Runners, yeah. And so he goes out and he retires. Dave Bautista, actually. And so he finds the remains in a crate buried under this dead tree, and it turns out the remains are that of Rachel, who is Sean Young, who was the femme fatale, let's say. And
the replicant who was more human than human and didn't know she was a replicant.
Well said. And then so she runs away with Harrison Ford's character Deckard at the end of the first film. What the police discover is that, surprise, she was pregnant. And that there is a replicant child or replicant human hybrid, depending on where side of the bed you get up on.
It's kind of...
But it's startling into implications, because I would assume that they would have made it so that replicants can't get pregnant.
But then there's also, you know, the implication that Terrell built her with that purpose in mind. I mean, Terrell did build her as, you know, we sort of discussed in the beginning, from the totally opposite point of view, where his goal with her was to actually give her life by making her more human than human, by letting her not know that she was a replicant. So perhaps he purposely also built her able to give birth, who knows how. And I think that's part of why Wallace was so insistent on finding it, not only because he wanted to create more replicants and recognize that he just simply couldn't, they just can't create enough and they need them to start being able to breed. So there's that. But I think that he was personally offended that this man was still smarter than him. This man had one secret that he has never been able to figure out.
Right. There is a bit of, spite there. And, it is interesting to wonder about. I think the implication is he. It's not like replicants are created, like, sort of mass produced on like an assembly line somewhere, and I think there's also an implication that since the first film, there are maybe more regulations or more rules in terms of how a replicant is made to make sure that, you know, more Roy Batty's don't happen, because that's something that's implied in the opening crawl, is that Roy Batty's wasn't the last replicant rebellion, so. He's trying to figure out more, and of course, what easier way would be more if replicants could make them make more replicants. So, yeah, there is a bit of peak in that in terms of, because he's the smartest guy in the world. You know, Tyrell is long dead at this point, so he's, you know, sort of the inheritor of the smartest man in the world title. So, that's a lot of that is what's driving it as well.
Yeah. So this for me is the one place where this movie truly fails, because the implication is that Rachel was pregnant with with Deckard's child, which forces viewers of the original Blade Runner to believe that Rachel and Deckard were in love. And I absolutely do not believe that. There is zero context for that whatsoever in the first film. There is no point whatsoever where Deckard shows any interest in her, save as a booty call, when he literally out of nowhere booty calls her, like out of nowhere. There's no, like, absolutely nothing happens, and he just calls. He's on a job and he just calls and says, hey, you want to come down to a bar?
Yeah.
And she says no, and he says okay, and then he sorry to say it, then he violently sexually assaults her, right? Like, it's just, there was no, and some people might fault Sean Young's acting, and maybe she was supposed to seem more into it, but I'm sorry, I can only look at it from the context of the film, and she was never interested in him, and he was never interested in her as a person, or as a, like, there was no love there whatsoever.
Yes, and One of the, perhaps an alternate interpretation I will offer is the love scene in the first Blade Runner. He kind of accosts her, and then he kind of, then he starts kissing her, and then he starts telling her what he wants her to say. Mm-hmm. And so there's a, kind of an element of fantasy building in that. That, like, in this moment, they're going to have this, like, perfect union, and that she's going to be what he wants her to be. And that plays into, I think, a broader theme in these movies, is that, you know, life is so horrible here, you kind of have to build your fantasy how you can take it. And that, of course, ties into the 2049, mm-hmm. where Ryan Gosling's character Kay has this live-in holographic girlfriend who always tells him what he wants and is the perfect companion. And of course,
built by Wallace again.
And then, of course, there's an awkward love scene in here where a prostitute character, her and the hologram kind of overlap. Mm-hmm. So it's like she gets the physicality to make his fantasy, which is to be physically with her, mm-hmm. come true. And that I found kind of, it was interesting, but it was also problematic too.
Yeah, it's definitely problematic. However, I will say, once I step back and just look at it as from a filmmaker's point of view,
mm-hmm.
oh my God,
yes.
I am overwhelmed by the amount of work and how well done all of the special effects were done on that. I cannot believe they must have spent a year alone just doing, working on that bit.
It's an amazing achievement, because there are scenes where you see Ana de Armas's features in Mackenzie Davis and Mackenzie Davis's
so
and Ana's.
Blended.
It was really well done.
Yeah.
And if that scene achieves nothing else, then bravo. Mm-hmm. Bravo, visual effects artist.
Yeah,
but yeah, the child aspect of this, I think, is also an extension of that fantasy. It's like, mm-hmm. we're gonna have this wonderful fantasy where we can have a child, and you know, there's this wonderful life that we could have in separate circumstances. If this wasn't like a replicant child, you know, we could have been a happy family and live somewhere nice. And but you know, this isn't that world.
Yeah. I did really enjoy that part, though, despite the fact that, you know, I had to pretend that I believed that Deckard and Rachel were in love, and not only just in love, but in love enough to actually, like, conceive.
Right.
So despite that, which I just sort of got rid of, I did actually really enjoy that idea. I think they did a really good job of making that the mystery. I mean, it's a very obvious sort of thing, right? Like, it's not, like, whoa, oh my God, it's obviously, like, here's this miracle birth of a person who's going to save the world. We've learned this story.
Yes.
Yeah. but it was really well done, and it was nice the way they sort of unraveled the little pieces here and there. It could have taken at least 20, maybe 30 minutes less time. And I think that a lot of that is that Jared Leto could have spoken a little faster, not had such dramatic pauses between every single word.
I can't put, I don't want, as much as I would love to put it on Jared Leto, I don't think I can put it on Jared Leto. I actually didn't mind the length. I managed to sit there quite contently and follow it along. So, I mean, that may be a personal thing. What I'm glad about, it was an obvious story, as you said, but what I'm glad about is that they kept it on the personal level.
Yep.
Because at the end, there's a scene where Kay is found by, like, they look like replicant kind of cultists because they're wearing robes, and could have done without that. But, you know, there's we're just waiting for the right time to, like, reveal the child, and she will, like, take us to the promised land or something. But, you know, there's a messianic thing about the Deckard and Rachel's child. But it never really gets into that. And at the end, it's all about, you know, that personal connection, and because they do find the child in the end. Mm-hmm. I don't want to spoil it terribly, but it's a deeply personal story, and it doesn't end with, you know, kind of a Lion King moment.
Yeah, thank God.
here is the Messiah of the new age, and presumably life is going to go on in a crappy way in this world for the foreseeable future, and, you know, maybe all you can do is lay down in the snow and watch it fall. So
snow, ash, whatever.
That's an excellent point. Yeah.
And I know we're running out of time, but I do just quickly want to talk about the score.
Yes.
Which is done by Hans Zimmer, and I hated it.
Oh, you hated it?
Okay. Yeah, I am so tired of that bass drop, boom, like dubstep sort of bassy sound that is in every single film. Every single film. Now, what I do like about it, even though I hated it, is that much like the Vangelis soundtrack, it is so completely of its time, because every movie right now has that soundtrack.
Yeah.
And so 15 years from now, we're going to listen to this and think, the soundtrack is so dated, just like people think the Vangelis soundtrack is so dated, but I love every second of
that
soundtrack.
I love it too. And before wrapping up, I'll just say I understand where you're coming from, but there's the scene near the beginning where he's flying back into LA and mm-hmm. you just hear the score, and there's something about it that is so unsettling. Like, I don't know if what I was feeling right now or what I was feeling for Kay, but he's flying into Los Angeles, and it's like, my thought was like, this is not somewhere we want to be.
Yeah.
So I think you might be right, but I also think the score had its moments too.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, it did what it was supposed to do, and it was a very future-sounding sound.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably does belong in this film. Maybe it doesn't belong in every other film, and that's where the problem lies.
Great point. And then we'll have to leave that there. So check out Blade Runner 2049 in a theater near you. It's an interesting film. And check out the original Blade Runner if you haven't. And check out our podcast. You'll find it on the open... I almost said open sources. You'll find it on the endcreditsradioshow.com website. And we are at Facebook at Ed Credits Radio Show and on Twitter, End Credits Radio. Candace, where can people find you on the internet when they're not Blade Running?
Well, you can find me at Sinn48, that's CINN48. I don't host three shows and have to remember all of the names of them, so I just have to remember Sinn48. There you go.
You've just essayed my nightmare. Anyway, speaking of shows, I'll be back here at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz there. And if you want to check me out online, you can go to Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram or guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. We will be back next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more end credits. And until then, we'll see you then.